Now we are actually online. Where were we up to? I think. Anybody remember? How many weeks ago is this?
Just last week. Just two.
There's an old question.
How many are we doing before
Pesach? We're not going there. We're not going there today. I'll figure that out next week. But there's a pasuk that says, "Azveni yom yomayim azveka." Abandon me for one day, I'll abandon you for two. Which in the yeshiva they sort of use as a drasha that if you miss a seder or you miss a shir or you miss a day of learning, it's like it doubles because it's not just the day you miss, but it's you have to get back into it. So when you miss 1 week of shir, it's like, and then you have to wait 2 weeks, and then you have to catch up and put your head back into it. It's really doubles the whole perspective. But we were at the beginning. We were sort of starting our review of Perek Yud, which is the which starts with the three otot that Shaul gives to Moshe. Which Shmuel gives to Shaul as a kind of proof or indication that he is in fact the one who is chosen to be the next king, and then. Post that story, it goes back to Shmuel's conversation with the people and the ceremony in which they designate an individual by lots who would be the choice for King of Israel. It turns out that lot confirms the choice that we saw earlier of Shaul, but of course Shaul is nowhere to be found because he is...
No.
He's hiding. Nechbal Akilim. Right, they go looking for him, and he's hiding. He's kind of like, so Shmuel goes and he finds him, and he drags him out, and he says, "Well, here's the man who's chosen as king." You sort of get this very strange moment of Shmuel's opening introduction to the people. Shaul's opening introduction to the people. I'm going to confuse Shmuel and Shaul all through the sefer. Just correct me, because I have that habit. What I wanted to do today is actually to go back to the beginning of this Perek, and spend a little bit of time looking at these otot, these signs that Shmuel gives to Shaul, the two people who meet him by Kefer Rachel, and the three people who meet him on the way to Beit El, bringing him gifts for the Beit HaMikdash, and then this choir or chorus of Nevi'im, with whom he will get caught up into and prophesy with them, Agam Shaul ben Nevi'im. All of this as a way of indicating to him that he is going to be the next, he is the correct choice, that the Nevuah of Shmuel is correct, that he is the designated one to be the king. And what I wanted to do is, I think we started this last year, if I'm not mistaken, we looked at other individuals who were chosen to be leaders of Israel at critical moments, also who were also given signs of some kind indicating the proof or substance of the appointment. Moshe on the one hand, and who was the other? Moshe is the obvious one at the burning bush. Who's the other? I won't grade you. It's okay. Moshe is the one we need to know for today, but the other one was Gidon. The other one was Gidon. Gidon and Moshe also have a certain amount in common, and that we talked about in Sefer Shoftim. But for now, what I wanted to do was to look at the comparison between Shaul and Moshe. Very specifically, Shaul and Moshe. Because not only does the point of reference move down a little bit and seats on over here and absolutely seats.
Here, why don't we move
excellent. Okay. So does everybody have a copy of the source page? It's one page. Should be two-sided, but it's one page. If you're short one, I have an extra. Is anybody short one? Anybody missing? All right. What I wanted to do is begin is focus today's discussion on a comparison between Moshe and Shaul. And those two specifically, because in a very real sense, they share both fundamental components of their story are in common. And then, of course, like most comparisons in Tanakh, they will digress at a certain point because that's the way it works. You compare and contrast. And certainly with regards to Shaul and Moshe, there's much to compare and there's much to distinguish between them. But let's start with the fundamental. In what fundamental way do Moshe and Shaul share a common destiny or a common role?
From their beginnings?
Say that again?
From their beginnings?
From their beginnings what?
Wasn't Shmuel a Nazir from the beginning?
Shmuel, I'm talking about Shaul.
They're both elected to take on
the role they're assigned.
Yeah.
Right, they're both elected. We're going to come back to the humility in a moment. They're both elected to be essentially the leaders of Israel, but not just leaders. They really are the first of their leadership role, meaning that Moshe is the first of his paradigm, be it Navi, be it warrior, be it redeemer. In many ways, Moshe plays the role of a king. He is the one who leads them into battle. He's the one who leads them into redemption out of Egypt. Right? But he's also a Navi. Certainly, Moshe plays that role of being the Goel, the Navi who leads them out of Mitzrayim. And Shaul is the first king of Israel. Excuse me?
And also Shofet.
Shofet, in that regard, Shofet Melech is sort of a similar type of role.
Okay.
And Shaul certainly was, with the whole conversation here is about him being designated as the first king of Israel. So in that sense, Shaul and Moshe share a certain common position of being the first of all who came after them. Being the first always has a certain spotlight on you, and therefore the question becomes, the success or failure of the institution hangs to a large extent on the success and failure of the first to create that institution. That's number one. But number two, when we start looking at the way in which each of them come to their position, the way in which they start as Shofet, as Navi, or Redeemer on the one hand and Melech on the other, there are certain common themes that run through the story. So we already saw structurally that which is what led us into this comparison in the first place. We saw structurally this kind of three otot given to each of them to say to them or to prove to them that they are legitimately the designated one for this role. That by in itself, that is so extraordinary that it begins this comparison. Moshe was given three otot, the staff, the hand turning to leprosy, and the water turning to blood, right? The three otot that he was given. And certainly Shaul was given three otot, three signs that he was, that this nevuah that he is to be the next king, the first king of Israel, is in fact legitimate and authentic.
Did Shaul question God the same way that Moshe did?
Oh, so that's an interesting question, and we don't have a really good indication to answer that question. In other words, on the face of it, it would seem that he does not. Right? In this whole parak, between the moment Shaul and Shmuel meet each other, moment where Shaul says to Shmuel, do you know where the Ro'eh is? And he says, I'm the Ro'eh. And then he introduces him to all the big dignitaries, and he says, this is all for you, and you're going to be... And Shaul's response, how can it be for me? I'm nothing, I'm a nobody, I'm the smallest of the tribes of Israel, I'm the... I'm the youngest of all the tribes, I'm the youngest of my family. From that point until the remainder of Perek Yud, what does Shaul say? Right, from the middle of Perek, from Perek Tet, Pasuk of Aleph, until the end of Perek Yud, what does Shaul say? Just a question.
Nothing.
He says nothing.
Okay.
Shmuel is doing all the talking. So Adina, in answer to your question, does he object as much as we don't know? On the face of it, there seems to be no objection. Actually, he does say something. He talks to his uncle.
He tells him about the donkeys we found, right.
He doesn't say much here, and he almost says nothing to Shmuel.
Yeah.
But they do have a conversation. We just don't know what that conversation is, because he takes him up to the roof at some point, right? If you remember the pasuk of Hay, Perek Tet, pasuk of Hay. He takes him up to the roof and he has an all night long conversation with him on the roof. The roof is like another room in a house. You understand the way they built houses then, the roof was a flat roof and it was used as a kind of functional, sort of like what we would do with the deck. Right? It was a flat space and it was used as kind of living space. So it's not a, they're not sitting, it's not a fiddle on the roof where they're sitting on the but Vedaber im Shaul alagag, there's Vayashkimu, and then the next day they're leaving. So he does have a conversation with him on the roof. We just don't know what that conversation is about. So we don't know if it's a strategic analysis of the situation of Israel or if it's trying to convince him to take this role and he's saying no. We just don't have that information. But we do have is the effort to try to convince him, the effort to try to convince Shaul that this Nevuah is authentic, and that's chapter 10. And that would indicate that maybe he wasn't so convinced, that he was still hesitant in the same kind of expression of humility that led him to say, I am the youngest and smallest of my tribes, and to hide amongst the baggage when he was anointed. Maybe that same humility was driving a sense of disbelief of this whole episode. So what I started to do is I started to collect both phrases and themes that parallel the story of Moshe and Shaul. Some of it is in the text, and some of it's actually in Midrashic literature. And the interesting piece about the Midrashic side of it is that I think the Midrashic side is being driven by this textual parallel. So, for example, Shaul's story begins, and this I've shared with you before. We talked about it when we did a mini-series on the role of Midrash a couple of months ago. Shaul's story begins when he innocently goes looking for his father's lost donkeys and he discovers Shmuel, who says to him, you're going to be the next king of Israel. Moshe's story has a slightly different beginning, leaving aside the Medrash. We'll see the Medrash in a moment. But Moshe's story begins, he finds the burning bush and God says to him, you're going to be the redeemer of Israel. But that story also begins with some kind of relationship between the individual and a flock. Right? So that's in the Medrash, that we're going to see in a moment. What's in the text is that he was a shepherd, and that he was shepherding his flock. So take a look at the first row of comparison, which is the appointment. It says minui mitoch da'agalatzon, appointment for, out of worry for the flock. The first column is the story of Shaul. The second column is the story of Moshe. So in Shmuel's case, sorry, in Shaul's case, it starts with the story of Vatavadna ha'atonot l'kish, avi Shaul, v'yomar kish al Shaul b'no, kach na'itcha et achad me'anealim v'kum lech b'keshet ha'atonot. That's the story. His father's donkeys got lost. Kish said to Shaul, go and find your donkeys, and that leads to the whole story. That's Shaul's beginning. That's in the text. In the text in the story of Moshe, all it says is, Moshe haya ro'eh et tzon Yitro. Moshe was a shepherd of Yitro's flock, his father-in-law, Kohen of Midian. Vayinhag et tzon achar hamidbar. He led the tzon, he led the flock to the desert, to the wilderness, or in this case, a midbar is a grazing land where you take the flock. Vayavo el har ha'elokim choreva. And there, he arrived at this mountain called Chorev, or the mountain of God, and he sees this vision of a bush that's burning without being consumed, and so he says, I will turn and I will see this great vision. What is this? Why does the bush not burn? That's the text at the beginning of Sefer Shmot Perek Gimel. But Chazal fill in a piece of the story that's not there in the text. And the Medrash very often will take an episode in Tanakh that's missing a piece, fill in the missing piece by drawing on themes that we're familiar with. And so the Medrash here tells a remarkable little story that we're very familiar with, but work it backwards, and what we're seeing is Chazal borrowing the story of Shaul and inserting it into the worldview of Moshe. What's the story? It says the Medrash is talking about various leaders of Israel who are all, in their prior profession, shepherds. David, Shaul, Moshe, working backwards, all the way back to the to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. Well, Avram and Yaakov, certainly. Yitzchak's. Almost. There's a whole host of them. So the Medrash goes to all of these great leaders of Israel who started their careers before they were chosen as Nevi'im or kings or leaders, started their careers as shepherds.
Wasn't shepherd like, you know, a common career occupation, right?
It is, but it has a certain unique parallel to the role of leadership.
Well, that's, I mean, right, I can understand. Right.
And that's not, it's not just a parallel in mind, it's actually a parallel in text, because Moshe, if you turn the page over for a moment, look at the very last box, left side of the bottom, which has to do with the appointment of a successor to Moshe. Bamidbar Chav Zayin, do you see it? Vayedaber Moshe al Hashem lemor, yifkod Hashem alokei aruchot l'chol basar ish al ha'edah. After Moshe knew that he wasn't going to be leading the Jewish people into the land of Israel, he said to God, let God appoint a successor, right? May the God who knows the spirit of all flesh appoint a man over the congregation. Ashi yitzei lifnem, ashi yavo lifnem, ashi yotziyem, ashi yiviyem, who should lead them, go out with them, come back with them, lead them in, lead them out, which is an expression for being a warrior, to lead the campaign, the army, into battle. V'lo tihye adat Hashem katzon asher ein lahem ro'eh. The congregation of God should not be like a flock without a shepherd. If you remember, we even looked at a parak in Yechezkel, where he talks about the kings of Israel, and it's called Nevuat Haro'eh, the prophecy of the shepherd. The corrupt shepherds, the good shepherds. The notion of being a leader of Israel was very much analogous in role to being a shepherd of a flock, in this case the flock being the congregation of Israel. So that's what this Medrash is reflecting on, and going back to the Medrash on the first side of the page, Shmot Rabbah Parshabet, V'af Moshe, Moshe 2, Lo b'chana HaKadosh Baruch Hu ela b'tzon, was tested via the flock. Meaning, not only was he chosen, but he was chosen out of a kind of test, if you will, of character vis-a-vis his role as a shepherd. Amru Rabbeinu, Kishaya Moshe Rabbeinu Alav Shalom Ro'et Tzono Shel Yitro B'Midbar, sages taught the following story. When Moshe Rabbeinu was the shepherd of his father-in-law's flock in the desert, Barach Mimenu Gdi, a certain kid or goat ran away. Baratz Acharav, and he ran after it. Ad Shigia L'Chasit, until he came to a certain area, Kivan Shigia L'Chasit Nizdanen Lo Brecha. When he got to this cleft or this area, this little goat found himself a pool of water. Brecha Shomayim, V'amad Agdi L'Shtot. And then this kid went over to the water and began to drink. Kivan Shigia Moshe Etzlo, and Moshe approached him. Amar, Ani Lo Hayiti Yodeh Sheratz Hayita Mipnei Tzameh. I didn't realize you ran away because you were thirsty. Ayevata, you must be tired too. Hirkivo Al Ktefo, so he picked up the goat and carried it on his shoulders, and he carried it back to the rest of the flock. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Yesh lecha rachamim linhog tzono shel basar v'dam kach, if that is the kind of compassion that you have for the flock of another human being, chayecha ta ti'eh tzoni Yisrael. In my life, in your life, you will be the shepherd of my flock, Israel. That's why the parasha begins, u'moshe haya ro'eh tzon. It's a beautiful little story. But embedded in this story is not an insignificant amount of parallel to our story. Because what is it that the Medrash says was the character of Moshe that made him worthy of being the leader of Israel? His devotion to the flock. Not just that he was a shepherd, but that in that role he showed great devotion to the individual compassion and devotion to the individual and self-sacrifice to the individuals within that flock. Here comes Shaul, and we know the story. Shaul is chosen as the king of Israel in a moment which highlights his devotion to the mission of finding a member of his father's flock. In the context that we talked about it once before, we talked about the fact that Chazal often used biblical stories to kind of merge or superimpose stories one upon the other. Right, this is one of those examples. But the message is, here's Moshe and here's Shaul, don't miss the comparison. Right, they both start the same way. If they both start the same way, then follow it through. And they both have three otot. And they both have other things in parallel. Then follow the parallel through, because what you'll find in the end is that which will highlight the uniqueness of each, for better or for worse. Okay. The next row we actually talked about when we went through Perek Tet. Even the language of the appointment of Shaul and the language of the appointment of Moshe share a certain common theme. In the case of Shaul, does everybody see where I'm reading? Yeah. Second row, first column. Mm-hmm. I'm just running through the rows across. When Shaul is chosen, it says, "Vashem galat ozen Shmuel yom echad lifnei bo Shaul lemor ka'et machar eshlach elecha ish me'eretz binyamin u'mshachto lenagid al ami Yisrael v'eshi et ami miyad plishtim ki ra'iti et ami ki ba'a tzakato elai." Shem had revealed to Shmuel, "Tomorrow I will send of you a person, Shlach Elecha Ish, from the land of Benjamin. You will appoint him as leader. He will save my people from the Plishtim, for I have seen my people, their cry has come to me. Ki ra'iti et ami, ki ba'a tzakato elai." Which is precisely the same language that at that moment, the conversation between God and Moshe at the burning bush, That was exactly the language God used to say to him, "You are the one I'm sending you to Mitzrayim." Vayomer Hashem, ra'o ra'iti et oni ami. I have seen the affliction of my people. Asher b'Mitzrayim ve'et tzakatam shemati. And I've heard their
cry.
Ki ba'at tzakato elai. And again in Pasuk Tet, v'atai ne tzakat b'nei Yisrael ba'elai. Their cry has come to me. V'gam ra'iti et halachat asher b'Mitzrayim lochatzim otam. V'yata lecha v'eshlachacha el paro. I will send you to Paro. God said to Shmuel, I will send you a man from Eretz Binyamin. The language, he was very specific. And again, once Chazal already highlight for us the parallel between Shaul and Moshe, as we begin to uncover the parallels, we see language, themes, context that draws them closer and closer together until we ask the question, what in fact is the difference between Shaul and Moshe? Even there...
So this is a very interesting comparison. Is this what you do when you're like you so well versed in Tanakh? You look for the comparisons. You go out of your way to find them. Is that the way?
Methodologically,
yeah.
Methodologically, I read people. I read articles of people who are smarter than me. But that's
you're
a
still good.
That's a truthful answer. But the. But the real answer. What?
But then you remember.
Well, that's why I write it down.
I was just curious from a learning standpoint.
Right.
Is this
where does it start from? I actually think it starts in the Medrash. I really think it starts in the Medrash. In other words, would we have come up with the depth of the parallel without the Medrash? Maybe. But I think that that's what Chazal highlight. And one of the roles of Midrashim for all is to, especially these kinds of story based midrashim that are built around other biblical stories, is to do that, is to highlight parallels that then beg a deeper analysis of compare and contrast. Certainly the case of, you know, the famous one is Moshe, is Abraham in the burning bush. Sorry, I'm confusing stories.
Yeah.
The most famous one is Abraham being thrown into the furnace of Nimrod, which is also not on the text of Chumash, it's a Medrash, right, which is clearly borrowed from story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah being thrown into the fiery furnaces of Nebuchadnezzar in the beginning of Sefer Daniel. There it's in the text, there it's an entire chapter, and there it's clear. And it's the same location. Bavo, Shinar, Nimrod, Nebuchadnezzar, Abraham, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. The parallels there are remarkable. I think that's a really powerful example where Chazal point to two stories and say, okay, now go compare and contrast them. And there are many points of comparison and contrast between them. We're not learning either story right now, but as an example, I think Chazal did that a lot.
Is there a point to be made by doing that?
Yes, because it highlights unique aspects of each, and that's what we're going to get to on the second side of the page. In our case, it will show us the strength of Shaul and also his failure. We'll get to that in a moment. Skip the next line, because it's part of the story we haven't gotten to yet. The fourth row we also looked at, which is the initial refusal of each, the humility reflected in each of their response to the appointment. In Shaul's case, where he said, "Halo Benyamini Anochi Miktanei Shiftei Yisrael, I'm from Binyamin, I'm from the youngest of the tribes, the smallest of the tribes, smallest of my families." By the way, Binyamin is much smaller than it needs to be at this point in time. Why? Because of the war against Binyamin in the end of Sefer Shoftim, Pilagish Begiva, regardless of when that story took place, early or late, it decimated an entire tribe. So catching up, they're much smaller in number than the other tribes of Israel are. That we'll see play a role in the next chapter.
Even going out of Egypt, weren't they a smaller number?
They were smaller than other tribes, and now they're even smaller because they were decimated. Moshe also had that initial refusal, Mi anochi ki alech al paro, who am I that I should go to Paro? And also that reflection of humility. In Moshe's case, humility is highlighted over and over again. Right? Whereas, and we see that's true of Shaul too. Right? It's not just one episode of humility. We see it as a pattern emerging in Shaul. We see it when he's in his initial refusal. We see it in the need to give him proofs, signs, otot. We see it when Shmuel is conducting this great ceremony with the lots, and the lot falls on Shmuel's name, on Shaul's name, and Shaul is nowhere to be seen because he's hiding amongst the utensils, nechbal akilim. So you see that humility. In Moshe's case, you also see that humility over and over again. It's a highlighted theme in Chumash. You see it in his refusal to go to, to go to Mitzrayim until God finally gets angry with him and he says, okay, enough. And then you see it when in his initial failure, but you also see it when, as a leader of Israel, Miriam, the famous story of Miriam and Aaron, who speak against him, Lashon Hara, whatever it is that they spoke, and he doesn't respond to it. And he doesn't respond to it, says the Torah, because of his modesty. Va'ish Moshe anav mikol adam asher apnei adama. Moshe was the most humble of all people. That's a very powerful statement. It's always ironic that who physically wrote that statement?
Moshe.
There's a Gemara in Sota, the end of the Gemara in Sota. It's one of my favorite little vignettes in the Talmud. I use it as proof that Chazal had a sense of humor. There's a conversation at the end of the Gemara in Sota, which the Mishnah lists various sages who were known for certain character traits. And when they died, says the Mishnah, that character trait died with them, meaning nobody's left to reach that stage. So in Rebbe, the character trait of diligence and learning died with them, and when this one died, the character trait of Chesed died with them. And then the Mishnah says, when Rebbe Yehuda Nasi, who was the redactor of the Mishnah, when he died, humility died with him. Batla anava min ha'olam. To which the Gemara then recalls in the Beis Medrash a conversation in which Rabbi Yossi stood up and said, you can't say that. And they said, well, why not? And he said, well, what about me? Vayika Anna.
So you say, what about Moshe?
Yeah. What about me? There's a lot of truth to that story. I want to come back to it in a few minutes to understand what that story teaches us. But in this case, anyway, humility is certainly part of their theme. We turn the story over, turn the page over.
You have to almost say it was that kind of humility that died, whatever the kind that was, because there certainly are plenty of...
Yeah, the extent, the extreme, right. The notion of the extreme representation of that.
Did we skip the last row?
I started that. That was the three signs that were given to each. That's where I actually had started with that. Interestingly enough, I think both Moshe and Shaul also faced a certain challenge of local opposition to their appointment. Just like everybody, right? Certainly, Shaul faced a challenge of opposition. Right? We read that story where, after he was found hiding in amongst the vessels, came out. He finally came and he stood before the people, and so the people and Shmuel said, "This is your king," and everybody said, "Yechi HaMelech." And then the pasuk says, "Pasuk of Zion, uvnev liyal amru." B'nei Belial, worthless people, evil people, turned and said, oh, what is this going to get us? What is this one going to save us? This is a nobody. This is a guy who has no backbone. He's hiding. When he's appointed king of Israel, what's he doing? He's hiding. Such a backbone we don't need. They despised him. They disparaged him. They didn't bring him the appropriate gifts of recognition of his being king. And Shaul's response, he was?
Deaf.
Silent.
Silent.
Vayehi kemacharish. What was Shaul's response to it? Silence. Ignore it. I don't need this. You know, they don't want to bring me gifts. Okay, so they won't bring me gifts. I'm not going to make an issue out of it. So he was silent. Now, is that a good thing or is that a bad thing? That's not clear. It's just a fact. He was silent in the face of those who opposed him. Much as Moshe was silent in the face of Miriam, and Aaron, who spoke Lashon Hara about him, and the Pasuk says, "Va'ish Moshe anav mikol adam asher pnei adamah." On the other hand, Moshe also faced an opposition to his initial appointment. If you remember his first encounter with Bnei Yisrael, when he first goes to Paro in the end of Parshat Shmot, didn't go quite as well as he had hoped. What happened?
He asked them to let him go.
And Paro said,
no way, and he made it harder for them.
He made it harder by declaring that they would now make bricks without straw.
Right.
That's us. That you'll bring a gut right. We'll now make bricks without straw. Moshe comes out of that first meeting. Vayifgu bo et Moshe v'et Aaron nitzavim likvatav. Moshe and Aaron come out of that first meeting, and men came to oppose them. Vayamru aleihem, and they said to them, Yirei Hashem aleichem v'yishpot, asher hivashtem et reichenu be'enei paro uve'enei avadav, latet cherev biyadam lehorgenu. He said, you have made our odor disgusting. You have given Paro a sword, a weapon in his hand, to further kill us and oppress us. You have done nothing but made it worse. And actually, Rashi says, who are the Anashim who came to greet, who are the ones who stood opposite Moshe at that moment? So Rashi plays on the word Nitzavim, that whenever that the word nitzavim in opposition to Moshe there is not just people of generic people, but very specific people who had a history of standing up against Moshe. In this case, specifically Korah. Datan and Aviram, or part of the Parsha of Korach, correct? Part of the rebellion of Korach. So Rashi links that rebellion or that moment to what happens later by Korach. Right, which is much like the same thing here.
But they were necessarily Bnei Belial. Right. Korach?
What, do you think Korach was right?
No, I just thought that he was jealous, but that, you know, that was a flaw, a character flaw, but that didn't mean he didn't have any redeeming character. I mean, his children still have...
Children, it's a different story. Children are a different story. The Pasuk says that they did tshuva, but that's a separate issue. His children are not Korach, but Korach himself, Datan and Aviram. You know, you look at Datan and Aviram's response to Moshe's call to them, offer to them, it would make the hairs in the back of our neck cringe. Right? You've taken us out of a land of milk and honey, but you haven't brought us to a land of milk and honey. Who made you rise above us? We're gonna, right, from the very beginning. Not the Nevi'im there. But what's interesting, I think, is Moshe's reaction to them. Because Moshe's reaction to Korach is very different from Shaul's reaction to the Bnei Belial. Shaul's reaction to the Bnei Belial was... Shaul's reaction to these people who challenged him. He said, nothing, what do I need? I don't need to stand up to them. I don't need to respond. What was Moshe's reaction to Korach, Datan, and Avira?
Called them rebels.
He calls them rebels. He stands up to them. He challenges them. If you want to look at Moshe, for Moshe's humility, That's not where you're going to find it. You might find it in the story of Miriam and Aaron. You're not going to find it in the story of Korach. And in fact, in the story of Korach, Moshe turns to God and says, Pasuk Perek Tetzayin, Bamidbar Tetzayin, Pasuk Tetvav, left hand side of the next row, Vayichar leMoshe Ma'od, Moshe was very angry, Vayomer El Hashem, Al Tefin El Minchatam, Lo Chamor Achad Mehem Nesati, Lo Ariyoti Et Achad Mehem, don't turn to their offering. I didn't take anything for my personal gain. I didn't take an animal from them. I didn't do anything wrong to any of them. I didn't do this for my benefit. I've been leading them loyally for all of these years. And here they have the audacity to rebel against me. Don't listen to them. Don't take their offering. Don't accept them. This is pure rebellion, pure evil. And that's exactly what God does. His reaction to them is to open up the ground and swallow them alive. Because to rebel against Moshe's leadership at that moment was an act of evil. Here is Moshe Rabbeinu, Noten HaTorah, who gave them the Torah, who selflessly devoted himself to the people from the word go, not for his own personal gain, and they attacked him for it. So let me ask you a question. Humility you're not going to see in the Parsha of Korach. And yet, in the story of Miriam, where they also attacked Moshe, he's silent, like Shaul was silent in his inauguration. And there Moshe's praise, Vaish Moshe Anav Mikol Adam. So wherein lies the distinction between where Moshe reacts to Korach harshly and where Moshe remains silent in the story of Miriam? What's the difference between the two stories that leads Moshe to react differently in each case?
What's it relative?
Relative, maybe. I'm not sure. That would put a little bit too much of a personal side to it.
But
maybe.
Wouldn't you think that both Miriam, who was initially, she helped save him to begin with as a baby, and his brother, who was his partner all the way through, that they're intentions were good, even if they were wrong.
So your Moshe's reading the intentions differently. Okay, I'll buy that. What else?
He doesn't want to hurt his
family. Right? Possibly. There's an element of there. I think there's something much bigger. Something much bigger in the distinction between what Aaron's and Miriam's conversation was about, and what Korach, Dathan, and Aviram's rebellion was about. One's personal, one's the authority of the leadership. Right. Moshe and Aaron was a personal attack. They misread, they misunderstood, that whatever the context was, it was a personal attack. Moshe's reaction to a personal attack would have been personal. Moshe's humility was great enough that the attack on a personal level wasn't going to affect him. Korach, Datan, and Aviram's rebellion was over his authority as leader. That's an attack that Moshe could not stay silent to, because when you challenge the position of authority, you challenge not the person, but the institution, and Moshe needs to protect that institution. That institution represents Torah. You weaken the authority of the Navi. You weaken the authority of the institution of leadership. Then you weaken it for generations. So there, it's not personal. It's mission mandated, and he has to react. That, in a sense, I think, is Shaul's mistake. Because when Shaul's And the people initially attack Shaul for his hiding at the anointment ceremony, is that personal, or is that over the institution and authority of the individual? Right. It's a little gray because he hasn't done anything yet. Right. But it does challenge his authority as king. Right? Mi Yoshien is that? Shmuel the Navi had just said, this is the new king, Yechia Melech, and they didn't bring him the mincha, they didn't bring him the offering that they were supposed to. And Shmuel's and Shaul's reaction is, oh, hey, it's just, right? It's not a big deal. But he doesn't understand completely that there are boundaries to modesty. There's a point at which modesty is personal, right? You don't have to take credit for that which you're able to do, because that would be boasting. But there's a point at which your position of authority requires, or leadership, I should say, requires that you protect the integrity of the institution. And then you have to stand up and lead. And that's Shaul's mistake.
When Shaul goes after David, is that personal?
Oh, we're going to get to that. Wait. A lot transpires between Shaul here and Shaul after running after David. Okay, we're a long way before Shaul's finished his psychological transformation. But actually, if you go back to the next row, where Shaul begins to fail. What's Shaul's greatest failure? What's his moment of greatest failure?
When he doesn't kill Amalek.
Amalek. Right? His battle of Amalek. Mm-hmm. And in the battle of Amalek, he does several things that are problematic. What he says to Shmuel in his defense is, why did he not... Whatever his crime was, it's unclear what his crime is, whether it was the animals that he left alive, or the people he left alive, or Agag he left alive, it's unclear. We're going to spend time analyzing that story. But what does he tell Shmuel is the justification for why he left the animals alive, or left the people alive?
They saved the best to bring as sacrifices.
And whose request was that?
The people.
People.
The people. The people came to him, they said, we want to save the animals. And Shaul said, okay. So Shmuel reacts. And what does he say to him? Now look at this next line. Shmuel Aleph Perek Tetvav Pasuk Yud Zayin. Vayomer Shmuel, Haloim Katon Ata Be'enecha Rosh Shiftei Yisrael Ata Ve'yim Shachacha Hashem Lemelech Yisrael. You may consider yourself small in your own eyes, but you are the leader of the tribes of Israel. God has anointed you king. There comes a point, says Shmuel, where humility has to be parked at the door, because
you
are the authority of the king. And if you know that people are doing something wrong and they want to do it, you can't say to them, like a wimp, right? You can't say, a backbone can't crumble at that moment and say, okay. And Shmuel's reaction, Vayomer Shaul's reaction, Vayomer Shaul Shmuel Chatati, Ki Avarti Et Nei Hashem Betvarecha, Ki Yareiti Et Ha'am V'Shamati Bekolam. I was afraid of the people. I listened to them. This is where Shaul crumbles.
He was supposed to be the leader.
The very humility, which is the character trait he shares so profoundly with Moshe, that starting point of Shaul and Moshe as two great leaders of Israel who demonstrated such humility, it's not for them, they're worried about the flock, they're worried about the sheep, they're worried about the donkey, and here there comes the perfect role model for the leadership of Israel, that very humility crumbles in the case of Shaul because it undermines the notion of the authority of the king. It's very hard to be super humble and to be super authoritative. Right. It's a very difficult balance. That, I believe, is the story in the Gemara in Sota of Rabbi Yossi, who stood up and said, you can't say that Rabbi Yehuda was the most humble of all people, because what about me? Right? With all of the humor involved, what he was really saying is, humility cannot be confused with the inability to stand up and lead. Humility basically says, you recognize that strengths and powers come not from you, but from the Ribbono Shel Olam. That the Ribbono Shel Olam has placed you into a particular role and you give thanks to Hashem. That's humility. Humility doesn't mean you walk around with your head in the sand, I'm a nothing, I'm a garnish, I'm a nobody, you're not kind of weak and meek. If you're going to be weak and meek, you're not going to be a leader of Israel. And nobody understood that balance better than Moshe. And that was why Moshe was anav mikol adam, was the quintessential paradigm of correct humility. Humility on a personal level, but the backbone to stand up to a Korach, a Datam, and an Aviram, and to lead with authority. Shaul got the humility right, but when the pressure started to mount, it crumbled. And Chazal, in the Medrash, point to the point, the beginning point at where you see Shaul's undoing. The point at which Shaul's, all of his goodness and all of his qualities and all of, and he was tall and he was powerful, and we'll see in Perek Yud Aleph, we're going to read a story which is the exact opposite. Shaul's standing up to the people with great authority and great power and great demonstrative leadership, where he's challenged with the people of Yavesh Gilad, they're challenged by the army of the oncoming onslaught of the people of Ammon, and he needs to motivate the people to go into battle, so he takes an ox and he cuts it up into 12 pieces and he sends a piece to each one of the tribes of Israel, and he says, anybody who doesn't come to the army now, this is what their fate will be. That's powerful. Shaul has it in him. But where does his undoing start? So look at the next medrash, which is the Alkut Shimoni on right below this psukim. Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, Mitnimah Ne'enash Shaul. Why was Shaul punished? Mipnei Shemachal Al Kvodo. Because he was willing to forgo his own honor. Meaning, remember, a while back we talked about the difference between a melech and a shofet. Whereas a melech doesn't have the authority to forgo the honor of the king. Melech shemachal al kvodo en kvodo machol. Why not? Because it's not about him, it's about what he represents. On the other hand, it's a very easy power to abuse. You have to be able to distinguish between personal and professional, leadership and individual. Says the Gemara, Shaul missed that balance. And he was willing to forgo his own covet. Where and when? Shenemar, ubnei Blial amru mayoshienu zevahi kemacharish. Way back at the beginning of the story, when Shaul was silent in the face of the detractors who said, "Who is this? Who will say this? Who is this guy?" When everybody thought he was being such a tzaddik, but in that moment there was a flaw that a couple of years later suddenly will unravel the tapestry of everything he represented.
But what should he have done? Kill all these people?
No, but he could have stood up and objected. And he could have stood up and said, listen, I've been appointed king.
Could have said something.
Right? You don't like it. I understand. But that's what it is. Didn't have to hide in the... it's really the continuation of the fact that he was hiding in the first place. Right? He knows that these are the Navi gave him these this information. He had three signs given to him. He knows. And yet he's gone to hide rather than stand up to the appointment. That's humility. Right? He's being humble. And I think he's being sincere about it. He never wanted this in the first place. But he's been thrust into this position and he has a responsibility that comes with it. It's a tough balance. It's a tough balance. Now, once that begins to unravel, something very unique happens. Both Moshe and Shaul, at some point in their lives, reach a point at which there's a crisis and there's a failure, and therefore the kingdom, the leadership, the position gets taken away from them. Shaul, in the case of Amalek, and Moshe by the rock, where he's told, okay, Moshe, you're done, 40 years, you're going to have a success. You're not going to lead them into the land of Israel, a successor will. What happens next is critical to understand the depth of the greatness of Moshe and the failure of Shaul. What's Moshe's reaction to the declaration that you will not lead them into the land of Israel? He begs God to forgive him, etc. But in the end, when that decree is final, he accepts it and he does something else. He asks God to appoint a successor. He's worried about the people. And that's the last row here. Bamidbar Chaf is where Hashem says to him, you will not lead them into the land of Israel. And in Bamidbar Chaf Zayin, Moshe says to God, I'm starting on the left column, Yifkod Hashem Elokei Aruchot L'chol Basad Ish Al Ha'ida V'lo Tiyah Dat Hashem Ketzon Asher En Lehem Ro'eh. Appoint a leader, appoint a successor. Can't have a flock without a shepherd. To which God says to him, Kach Lechat Yehoshua. Yeshua is your right-hand man. Yeshua has been loyal to you. Yeshua is loyal to the people. Yeshua is the right choice for successor. There's a whole conversation about why, whether Moshe wanted his sons to be successful or not, but Moshe's sons were not going to succeed him. Yeshua was that choice. And Moshe completely accepts that and does exactly as God tells him. What does Shaul say when God says to him, the kingdom is going to be torn from you? And what is Shaul's reaction to the battle of Amalek? And he takes his garment. Do you remember the story? On the right hand side. Vayomer Shmuel al Shaul, lo ashuv imach. Shmuel says, Shaul had said to Shmuel, just come back with me when I return to the people, come and stand with me. He didn't want to be seen alone because that would have been seen as being rejected by the Navi. So he says to him, come and stand with me. Shmuel refuses. Shmuel turned to go. So Shaul grabbed Shmuel's garment, and he pulled. Vayikra, and it tore. Vayomer elav Shmuel. Shmuel turned to him, and he said, "Kara Hashem et hamamlachut Yisrael me'alecha hayom unetana le're'acha hatov mimecha." Malchus has been taken from you and given to the one who is greater than you. And the result that comes next is the rest of Sefer Shmuel, which is, after the kingdom is after Shmuel secretly anoints David, and when David becomes Shmuel's assistant, and he comes into the kingdom, and then he marries his daughter as a warrior in Shmuel's king in Shaul's kingdom, the moment Shaul sees that the people are more concerned that David is more popular than he is, what happens to Shaul?
He goes crazy.
He goes paranoid. And you could write a doctoral dissertation on the psychosis of Shaul. Because he really does get paranoid and he really does go crazy. And the result is that he completely loses everything he'd accomplished. Why? Because he fights to the end of his last breath, he fights a civil war that will rip the people apart to preserve his kingdom. So the irony of Shaul is that post the story of Amalek, Shaul is anything but humble. He's the exact opposite. He is paranoid. He is he's cruel. He wants to kill David. He'll lead the people into a civil war, all in order to preserve his kingship. And for him, the kingship becomes the goal unto itself, rather than the means of the role of leadership of the people. It's a very terrible tragedy. But it starts from this humility, which is so misplaced in the, so beautiful and so praiseworthy on the one hand, and on the other hand, when you compare it to Moshe, you see how misplaced it is, and how it ultimately not only trips him, but becomes transformed into the depth of his paranoia and of his fight to survive in his position, even in the case of civil war. So all of this starts from a simple statement that Chazal make. You can't understand Shaul unless you compare Shaul to Moshe. Start with that comparison, and the rest of the story becomes clarified. So that's the answer to the question you asked at the beginning. Where are we going? I think Sylvia also asked me that question. Where does this lead us? Most comparisons lead us to some conclusion on one or the other. It'll lead us to either a greater understanding of the individual's challenges and context, as in the case of Avraham, where the Torah tells us really very little about the background and the personal journey and the self-sacrifice and the commitment that he had as a single person believing in monotheism in an environment that was pagan. The Torah tells us none of that. But the Torah tells us a great deal about it in the case of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And so if you take that story and superimpose it back into the world of Avraham, suddenly you have a greater appreciation for who Avraham was and what he was facing. Or that comparison highlights the deficiencies by comparing one leader against the backdrop of an even greater one. And that's, I think, in the case of Shaul and Moshe, what emerges from that story.
But even Moshe doesn't get his dream.
No, but he doesn't get his dream, but he has the character to understand the responsibility of leadership is to be concerned for the people. Julie, it's a remarkable story. All right. Bezrat Hashem, next week we will have the focus of the shiur next week, I hope, to be on the discussion of Kever Rachel and on the location of Kever Rachel and on the role of Kever Rachel and the meaning of how Kever Rachel ended up in the story of Sefer Shmuel. That, Bezrat Hashem, is our agenda for next year.